anytime you want to.
Okay, good. This is an interview with John Goddard of Village Music on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, 2006. I'm Allison Owings, and Tim Amix is doing the video. And I wanted to ask you, sort of going backwards first, you said that you had a Taiwan buyer who came in last week, and it was a big order. What did he or she buy?
He works for a chain of 15 stores in Taiwan, and he bought 20,000 albums.
Wow.
Of all genres of music.
Wow. Nothing in particular?
No.
That'll keep you in business for a month or two, huh?
cleans out my storeroom a little bit. I probably had 80% of it, more copies in stock. But
speaking of your storeroom, tell me where it is. And I wondered if you could give me a sense of inventory here and there.
Yeah. I share a wall with the kitchen of Toast. I'm back across the street. And I would say in here I've probably got 100,000 album. Well, fewer than that this week, but 100,000 albums and probably a couple of 100,000 45s and about 10,000 78s. And my storeroom has almost as many albums and probably twice as many 45s.
And when did you decide to face the music, so to speak, and start carrying CDs and tapes?
I've carried them all along. I've been primarily a record store because when I got into this, it was because I was a record collector and I wanted to feed my habit. I've been a record store. I haven't been an entertainment center, so I haven't like jumped headfirst into all the new formats. But I've always carried cassettes. I used to carry 8-tracks. In fact, I still have some. I've always carried CDs. Actually, I carry a lot of CDs. It just doesn't seem like it because they're overwhelmed by the records. I've probably got an inventory of 15,000 CDs, which is not a bad, mm-hmm. It's not a bad little chunk.
And how many records, 45s, whatever, CDs do you have at home?
I've actually been cleaning out my collection the last couple of years. I've decided I don't need all of the records in the world. I've probably got maybe 7,000 or 8,000 albums and maybe 5,000 45s and maybe 7,000 or 8,000 78s and maybe 1,000 CDs.
How do you organize them?
They're all very organized. They're all alphabetical and by category of music and all of that. I can pretty much find anything at home, anything that I haven't gotten in the last year or two, because sometimes it takes me a while to get it all processed. But I can pretty much find anything I'm looking for. Same in the store. I'm a firm believer if you can't find it, you might as well not have it. And if you can't find it, you certainly can't sell it.
Are you computerized?
Just up here.
Okay.
When that goes, that's it.
That's your hard drive.
Yeah. My hard drive is between my ears.
Okay.
And getting softer.
And I wondered if you could tell me, I want to talk more about the store, of course, mm-hmm. but tell me about your early years growing up and your family history here.
Okay. My mother's parents moved here in the 1890s. My grandfather was an importer and lived in a couple of houses on Miller Avenue until, I think, 1908, 1909, somewhere around there, and then they built a house down on Sycamore. And they had four kids. My mom was actually born in the master bedroom down there. My father was from Texas, probably 10 generations of Texans. I mean, they go back hundreds of years. And he came out here in the early 30s because his brother had come out here to set up practice. And so when my dad graduated and got his degree in medicine, he came out here and set up practice with my uncle.
Where did your grandparents who moved here come from?
My grandfather was from France. My grandmother was from Ireland. I'm not sure. They met back east somewhere, but I'm not sure where.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever consider not living here?
I consider it. You know, I'm not necessarily thrilled with what the town's become in the last many, many years. And I toy with the idea, but I can't imagine moving. I mean, I love, there's parts about the town I really love. I love my house. I could see retiring and never leaving the house, but I do, I love where I am, and I fantasize about moving somewhere, but I'd be real surprised if I ever did it.
Where is your house?
Back up in Blythedale Canyon.
Oh. And how long have you lived there?
Since 1969.
Oh. Yeah. Did you build it?
No. No, I bought it, from one of the Buck family, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Buck's son.
Mm-hmm.
And he had bought it, the next door neighbor had built it in the late 40s for he and his wife, and by the time he finished the house, his wife was too sick to navigate stairs, so they never moved in. And there were a couple of owners, two or three owners, before I bought it.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you tell me something about your childhood here, and what, which is probably a segue, I guess, into what you did and still do like about the town, and what you no longer like so much about it?
You really want to go there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, like I said, I was born here. I went to Park School. I went to Marin Catholic. Then I went away to college in '61 and was in college for 7 years until I flunked my draft physical.
And where was that?
I went to University of Santa Clara for 2 years and West Valley Junior College for 2 years and San Jose State for 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And right about the time I was getting out of school, I'd worked here in high school. Mm-hmm. I started working here when I was 13. And about the time I was getting out of college, they decided to get out of the business, and through a long, involved process, I ended up here. But, you know, I was born in this town. I've seen it change a lot. It was a fun, you know, I did all the ballroom dancing, tumbling, played tennis. I was a member of the tennis club, did all the Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, did all that kind of stuff.
And today? You can mention SUVs and...
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples that to me explain the town as much as anything else. 20 years ago, 80% of my business was local. Now, 80% of my business is from out of town.
Hmm.
I was recently written up very nicely in the Pacific Sun. I mean, it was a half-page article. It was really well done. And it fascinated me that I had one person come in the store and mention they'd seen it. Hmm. You know, I don't have a local clientele, and I think on some level I resent that. But on another level, the town doesn't feel comfortable like it was when I was a kid. And maybe, again, that could have just been my perception. But, you know, when I went away to college, nobody locked their doors.
Mm.
When I came back from college, people had started locking doors, and burglary had become a problem. You know, it was a very wide-open town.
What about the money factor here these days?
I'm a little bothered by it. I'm bothered by the money factor on a couple of levels. I don't think it's right that children that grow up in this town can't afford to live here, and that has been true for a long time. I mean, most of the people I went to school with couldn't afford to live here. If I'd waited, I bought my house in '69. If I'd waited 5 years, I never would have had the money to buy a house in Mill Valley. You know, I got in right under the wire.
Mm-hmm.
I paid $38,000 for my house, and my parents thought I was crazy for paying that much. But if I'd waited, you know, just even a few years, I never, ever would have had the income to buy a house here. And I don't think that's right. I mean, children should have the option of living where they grow up if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
I have a big problem with the fact that teachers and firefighters and police can't afford to live in the town that they work in. You know, I there's something fundamentally wrong with the community where that's the case.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a national sentiment, maybe international sentiment.
Yeah, I mean, the people that help us should be able to live mm-hmm. where they work. Because, you know, God forbid we ever had a disaster, I certainly couldn't blame any firefighters or paramedics or police officers for going to their family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and their families aren't here.
Can I jump in with a question? It's a follow-up question to what you said a minute ago about the most of your buyers are out-of-town people. Mm-hmm. And you've probably seen the same thing happen with hardware stores and department stores where pretty much everything is the economics, the way economics have changed. They're the bigger stores, the superstores, and they're in the Novato, the Santa Fe. How has that affected you, and how close have you come to saying, you know what, I just can't cut it in Mill Valley. Everyone's buying their records from Tower Records in Corte Madera.
I mean, on a perfectly selfish level, yes, that's very true. But I think it goes beyond that. I don't think the residents of this town shop in the town, and I don't know if that's on the residents for not shopping here, or if it's on the town for having a lot of businesses that, to me, don't seem functional. I mean, how many nail places do you need? You know, how many beauty salons and spas do you need? How many women's clothing stores do you need? How many little pseudo-furniture stores do you need? I mean, you can't buy a pair of socks downtown. You can't buy sheets downtown. You can't, there's not a hardware store downtown. There's not a drugstore downtown. And one of the things I used to love about Mill Valley is that there were all these little stores where you could, you know, there was a good bookstore. The Depot serves a purpose, but it's not what I would call a good bookstore. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's true, and it's a catch-22. I mean, I think people don't shop in the town because there's no place to shop, and there's no place to shop because you have to depend on the tourists because the people don't shop in the town. And I don't know where it started.
Well,
it's kind of the chicken and the egg thing.
It certainly must have started in part by raising rents. And I wondered, that brings me to your store. Do you own your building?
I don't own my building, and I will be closing probably in the not-too-distant future because of the rent.
Really?
I mean, it's a lot of factors, but the deciding factor when and if I close will be the rent. You know, in the last 10, 15, 20 years, I imagine you could check with the sales tax board. Sales have gone down in Mill Valley. They're probably half what they were 20 years ago, taxable sales. But the rents are quadruple and more.
Would you say how much your rent is?
Including my storeroom, I'm at about $11,000 a month. Without my storeroom, I'm over $9,000. Oh. Which is just not...
Yeah.
You can do a restaurant on that kind of rent. You can't do a... You can't do a retail business.
Who's your landlord?
The guy that owns Stefano's.
Oh, the solar
Bob,
pizza.
Bob Valentino. Yeah, pizza guy.
How many landlords have you had over the years? How many times has it changed ownership?
Not that many. My original landlord, let me say while I'm talking about Bob, I don't blame the landlord. I have to admit the rent is probably cheaper per square foot in this particular building than it is most of the buildings in town. I've got a big space. I mean, to do what I do, I need a lot of space, and that's a big factor. It's not that he is gouging the tenants. You know, he paid a lot of money for the building and has to pay for it. And as it is, it's lower than most of the places in town. When I took over the store, there was a guy in Tiburon named Fred Palmer that owned it, and he died right about the time I took over the store in the late 60s. And it was in a bank trust for probably 25 years. Okay. So I was dealing with banks and various and sundry administrators for a long, long time. And then they sold the building 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And so that's when things got a little...
Yeah, so I haven't had that. I've had a lot of bank administrators, but I haven't had a lot of landlords.
Do you have any problem with shoplifters?
Not so much anymore, because I think the mentality of shoplifting tends to be stuff that it is mostly kids. I hate to be ageist about it, but it is mostly kids. And they tend not to be that interested in records, and the CDs aren't out available. You know, they're in back. So I don't, I probably lose more than I think I do, but not enough to be a problem. I'm a firm believer, if I don't catch them and I don't know what's been taken, I don't care. It's when I find out about it.
Yeah. And do you not have the CDs here for space or for shoplifting?
It's a space problem. Shoplifting's part of it, of course, but it was a conscious decision when I started carrying CDs. Am I going to expand my CD selection at the expense of my record inventory, or am I not? and I didn't. I mean, I can hold 15,000 CDs here.
Mm-hmm. And you get these cards from the manufacturer?
No, I Xerox them myself.
Oh, I see. It's all done. I've never seen them before.
No, oh. You won't. It's all done by hand. It's just color Xeroxes of the cover.
Uh-huh. Where do you get it done?
RAM.
Uh-huh. I know RAM very well. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to go back more to music and your music tastes and some of the people you've run across or who've come in here. I wonder if sometimes you hear a particular song or particular artist and suddenly there's a hair on the back of your neck standing up feeling.
Not so much anymore. It has certainly happened. I went and saw Little Richard when I was 13 and it changed my life. That was the first rock and roll show I went to. Mm. I got that feeling the first time I saw Janis Joplin. I got that feeling the first time I saw Ry Cooder. Got it the first time I saw Jerry Lee Lewis. Got it the first time I saw Otis Redding. I got it big time when I saw Judy Garland. Got it big time when I saw Frank Sinatra. You know, there, it covers a lot of areas. There's a couple of gospel shows that just turned my head around. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of music that have done that to me through the years.
All your examples, though, are live music. What about hearing a record?
You've Lost That Loving Feeling by the Righteous Brothers was a good example.
Yeah.
Don't Worry Baby by the Beach Boys was a good example. Of course, Heartbreak Hotel was the first example. That's the first record I bought. First time I heard a Muddy Waters single. But a lot of it was live music because I started going when I was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go?
I saw Little Richard at Mission High School in San Francisco. And within then I went to a show at the Cow Palace about 2 months later and saw Fats Domino and Frankie Lyman and Clyde McFadder and the Everly Brothers and Paul Anka and Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran. You know, it was one of those big package shows. And then that summer, I was 13, I convinced my parents that it was absolutely perfectly safe for me to hop on a Greyhound bus and go to the San Jose Civic Auditorium by myself. And I started doing that, which was nuts, because they had knife fights, and, you know, I'd take a local bus back from San Jose at 1 o'clock in the morning, and here I am, a little 13-year-old with my Brownie camera hanging out in the San Jose bus depot. But my parents went for it, and I got to criticize them for the stupidity involved, but it's what made me what I was, and I never had a problem.
Huh.
So I was, you know, I saw Ray Charles when What I Say was his first record.
You saw him there?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw James Brown when Try Me was his current record. I saw James Brown when Try Me was his current record. I saw the Everly Brothers when Wake Up Little Susie was their current record. You know, and I saw people like Buddy Holly and Richie Valens, and I saw Elvis Presley before he went in the Army in his gold lamé suit. You know, I did, and my parents used to let me do that, and they were nuts to let me do it. But as a result of it, I got real involved in music. I'd been a collector all my life. I mean, I used to collect rocks, and I used to collect bird nests, and I collected comic books, and I collected coins, and I collected stamps. And then music happened, and I started collecting records. And I started working for Village Music because I got a discount on my records.
Let me ask you a question that might lead to that. You went to
Marin Catholic
High School.
My parents did not approve of me going to a school where there were actually black people involved.
Well, while you were at Marin Catholic, did you play an instrument, or were you influenced by any music teachers that led to your
fascination? Not
at all. Fascination?
I got an electric guitar when I was in the 7th grade. No, it was a 58, so I was 14. And I got an electric guitar for a Christmas present, and I couldn't play What I Say by New Year's, so I gave up. I really wanted to do that guitar intro, and I never went any further. I didn't play an instrument in high school. I did, however, have the only record collection. So I went to a lot of parties, and I played music at a lot of school dances. I made a humongous leap, too. I mean, I started out in, like, March with Elvis. Well, I started out at Christmas with Elvis Presley. In March, I moved on to Little Richard, and by the end of summer, I was listening to Jimmy Reed and Muddy Waters. You know, I made a huge leap really quickly.
Mm-hmm. You didn't stick with a king.
No. I pretty much moved into black music, and really, that's where my heart was until I started going to the Fillmore and Avalon.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you tell me something about the musicians who have come here and bought? I've read some stories, but maybe you could tell me some highlights, or I'll ask you about ones if you...
Well, you can check my website and get a fairly complete list.
Oh,
but,
okay.
All right. I mean, through the... It's been a really broad spectrum. I mean, I've had Elvis Costello and Mick Jagger and Jerry Garcia and Bonnie Raitt and Carlos Santana and Van Morrison and all the San Francisco bands. On another level, Cab Calloway's been in here. Mel Torme's been in here. On another level, Wayne Shorter's been in here. John McLaughlin's been in here. On another level, George Lucas, Drew Barrymore, Matthew Broderick, Matt Dillon, you know, there's different areas. George Lucas once told me he researched the entire soundtrack of American Graffiti out of my store.
Well, that's nice to know.
Yeah. He came in right after Star Wars opened, and I thanked him for making one of my favorite movies, and he was ready for the Star Wars wrap, and I said American Graffiti, and he says, well, I have to thank you. I researched the entire soundtrack out of this store.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, I would like just your impressions of Mick.
Short. He's very short. that's a real good story. He was rehearsing for his first solo tour back when his first solo album came out, and he was rehearsing up at Skywalker Ranch, and he was living at Bill Graham's house up on the hill, mm-hmm, in Corte Madera. And he was here for 3 weeks, and I pulled every string I had to get somebody to talk him into coming by the store. You know, I talked to BGP, I talked to a couple of disc jockeys, I talked to some people I knew up at Skywalker Ranch. I mean, I really wanted it to happen. In fact, Bill Graham walked in one afternoon, and he says, I hear you'd like my house guest to come by your store. And I said, yeah. I really would. And then there was an article in Herb Kane that he'd left. He'd gone to Japan. And the next day, I'm working. It's like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and these two heavy metal headbangers come walking in the door and go, hey, dude, Mick Jagger just drove by. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, sure, he left town yesterday, numbskull. And then Jagger walked in. And with his entourage of two, and he walked in, and he goes, I've been told this is a stop I should make before I leave town. And he seemed really nice, you know. He signed some stuff with no problem at all. He was looking. I've got some old ads for the Apollo Theater along the bottom down here, and he was looking at those and going, I went to that show, and he was charming, you know, and it was the only time he came in.
Did he buy anything?
He bought about $400 worth of cassettes to listen to on the flight to Australia.
Oh, boy. What was his taste?
He was on a reggae phase at the time. He bought some other stuff, but he bought a lot of reggae.
Mm-hmm. And what phase are you in now? I understand that you say that you go through lots of them.
Not really one so much anymore. I started out in rock and roll. I moved to blues and R&B and stayed there for a lot of years. And now I'll listen to gospel music for a week, or I'll listen to country music for a week, or I'll listen to, I'll get on a Judy Garland kick. You know, it when I go home, I listen to classical music because that's what my wife usually listens to, mm-hmm, which is something I've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just all kind of depends on what mood I'm in. I listen to a lot more doo-wop than any of my help here would care to hear.
But you could.
I've been listening to a lot of Jerry and the Pacemakers and Freddie and the Dreamers the last couple of weeks because somebody traded in some British Invasion CDs, and I've just been whipping through those. You know, there's no pattern to it. There's no pattern to it.
Would you tell me a little about your wife?
Again, born and raised in town. Her father Her father was a real estate agent here in town. Her mother was a classical pianist who gave piano lessons. Her twin brother was John Cipollina in Quicksilver Messenger Service. Her younger brother was Mario Cipollina, who was in Huey Lewis in the News. Just local.
What's your name?
Michael Cipollina.
Her name?
Michael.
Is Michael.
Yeah.
Spelled like Mike.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like Mike.
Okay.
Yeah. We knew each other growing up. I was in Boy Scouts with her brother. I knew her in high school. Asked her out a couple times. We never went out, and we actually connected in the late '80s at a memorial for her mother at Sweetwater, and asked her out for a cup of coffee, and we've been together ever since.
Oh, great!
But she's another local.
Is this the first marriage for you both?
No, it's her, she's been married twice before, and I was married twice to the same person before. So I don't know if that counts as one or two.
Yeah, I don't either.
But that was 30 years ago.
And does either of you have children?
She's got five.
Now, I would imagine that on an emotional, emotional level almost more than a musical level, you miss Jerry Garcia terribly. But tell me, tell me about...
I miss him because I felt like he was a friend. I mean, we didn't hang out together, but we were friends. You know, he'd come in regularly. First time he came in, he was amazed. I had Joseph Spence records in the store and was a customer ever since. I don't know if you know who he is.
No.
He's a Bahamian guitarist. Pretty esoteric. And this was 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. You know, but we connected. You know, he and David Grisman did their first public performance at one of my Christmas parties.
Oh boy. I've been reading about Grisman too. I didn't realize he lived in Mill Valley.
Actually, he's in Petaluma now, but he lived in Mill Valley for years and years and years.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, do you, this might sound extremely esoteric, but do you find yourself kind of dreaming one music or another?
Not really. I hardly ever remember my dreams. Let me start there. Uh-huh. But I hardly ever dream about music.
Well, you probably have no need.
Yeah, really.
Psychological need. And do you listen to headsets?
No. Can't stand them. I like to be doing stuff when I listen to music.
Yeah.
You know, I can't just sit and listen much anymore. You know, if I'm lying in bed, I'll listen to the radio maybe, but I don't really. When I'm home, I watch movies more than I listen to music, because I get music in here 8 hours a day, and that's pretty much a good fix.
And is, so no iPod either?
No.
Got
me. I don't know how to work a computer. You know, my wife handles my website, and I couldn't get you to my website if my life depended on it.
The website's very sophisticated. I must say I was surprised.
Thank you.
Well,
my wife thinks it's in serious need of updating, and I think it looks just fine.
Well, for someone who doesn't computerize his inventory.
A friend of mine did that for me for free.
Well, it's very nice. You click on whirling records to get to different spots.
Yeah.
It's really nice, I thought.
Thank
really
you.
Nice. Yeah. And I want to hear about Burton. Is it James Burton, Elvis's guitarist?
Uh-huh.
What was he like, and did he tell you any stories?
Not too many so much. I don't get awestruck very often, but I was awestruck by James Burton. I mean, that was one of the musical highlights of my life, was actually having James Burton play at one of my store's anniversary parties. And in fact, subconsciously, I think the reason I asked Elvis that particular year to do it was because he was touring with James Burton. I mean, James Burton's a god as far as I'm concerned. He's just a major guy.
You asked Elvis?
Yeah.
To the party?
Yeah, he played one of my anniversary parties.
No.
Yeah.
This is what we call burying the lead to me.
Oh, really? No,
big Elvis.
My 21st anniversary party was an evening with Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and friends, and Elvis did a solo set, and then Nick Lowe did a solo set, and then Elvis came out and played a set with James Burton and Jerry Garcia. Charles Brown performed, a couple of the Fabulous Thunderbirds, Sammy Hagar, Bob Weir. It was a pretty much endless non-stop stream of music, but it was the first time Elvis had met Jerry Garcia. I had the joy of introducing them.
You're talking about Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking about Elvis.
No, Costello. Okay. Costello, yeah.
So James Burton was Elvis Costello's guitarist?
James toured with Elvis for 2 years.
With Elvis Costello?
Yeah, with Elvis Costello. Okay, he toured with Elvis. Oh, no, he started out...
Okay.
He started out playing with Rick Nelson for years. Then he went to Elvis Presley for years. But at the time I met him, he had been touring with Elvis Costello. Now he's touring with Jerry Lee Lewis.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you happen to see Elvis Costello with Hardly Strictly Bluegrass?
I saw him Friday, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there, too. Yeah. Yeah.
I went to the rehearsal the night before, too, which was a lot of fun.
I bet. Yeah, did you see it, Tim? It was rocking. He seemed so comfortable.
I've pretty much been to 3 shows this year. I don't go to concerts much anymore because, I've seen everybody that I want to see a dozen times and everybody else is dead. But I've been to like 3 major shows this year. Elvis Costello at Louise Davies, Elvis Costello and Alan Toussaint at the Paramount, and Elvis Costello in Golden Gate Park, and that's been about it.
He was, he just seemed so comfortable in himself.
The breadth of what he's doing now, I mean, this year he toured with symphony orchestras, performing a symphonic piece that he composed. He toured with a New Orleans rhythm and blues band and Alan Toussaint. He's toured, then he did the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass, and he's done, he's been doing dates just all over the place with all kinds of people. I mean, he's recording with Tony Bennett, he's sitting in with Wanda Jackson, he's duetting with Emmylou Harris. I mean, the breadth of what he's doing is just phenomenal. I mean, he's so knowledgeable about music.
Mm-hmm. And does your wife go with you to some of these concerts?
She has in the past. She doesn't much anymore. She's got emphysema and can't really do large venues much anymore.
Oh. And do you sing?
No.
Nothing?
No. I sing along in my car, and that's about it.
So what do you play in your car? Well, I don't mean just the music. I mean, is it CDs or is it tapes?
Actually, I've got an 8-track in my 56 Chevy, and I've got a CD player and radio in my 57 Chevy.
You cover the waterfront.
Yes, I do.
And what... I was wondering what kinds of changes you would like to see, if any... that you haven't mentioned in any event, in this town, as well as in the music business, as you know it.
Either or, both and?
Yeah.
Town. I'd like to see people lighten up a little bit. I'd like to see some maybe black people or brown people living in town. Mm-hmm. When I went to Marin Catholic, there was one black person in the school. When I went to Edna McGuire, there was one black person in the school. And, the town really hasn't changed that much since then. It's still pretty homogenized. Mm-hmm. And the people, to me, seem to be interchangeable. There doesn't seem to be a lot of there. And I can say the same thing about the music business. There doesn't seem to be a lot of there.
I see. Would you be willing to say... mention any musicians or singers whom you think have been in their career overrated?
Oh, God, where do I begin? get me a Billboard chart. I'll read off the top 20 for you. it's not even a matter of overrated. There's some great voices out there. There's some country singers now that have incredible voices, but the songs are sterile. The music in the background is just sterile. I mean, you can only do so much with a drum machine. You can only do so much with a synthesizer. And it's just And the song, you know, the songs don't grab me. I can't remember the last time I heard a new song that said, ooh, go out and buy me. Buy me, buy me. You know, and it just, you used to get that all the time. All the time. You know, you could listen to a new album and there were like seven songs on it that you just not only liked a little bit, that just knocked your socks off. And it doesn't happen anymore. You find a good single with a hook on it and the rest of the album usually sounds like the single. Or there's just nothing there. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not... The record companies don't seem to be building careers anymore. They're building songs. You know, they'll have an album that sells 5 million copies, but they're not establishing a career. By the next album, that group is gone. You know, they've become the CD version of a one-hit wonder. You know, there's no legs. And if that had been true 30 years ago, Bonnie Raitt never would have kept a career. Ry Cooder never would have kept a career. Elvis Costello never would have kept a career. Randy Newman never would have kept a career. You know, it just, they don't build careers anymore. And the result of it is there's no careers out there.
Now I'm thinking of some of the people whom you liked a lot and who went to... your parties, could you tell me, and you mentioned them a few times, so you have legendary parties, I gather. Legendary.
I have had parties? On and off, if I get inspired.
You get a nice box of wine.
Yeah. I mean, here I am sitting at Sweetwater with Elvis Costello and James Burton and Jerry Garcia on stage at the same time. 2 years later, I'm sitting at Sweetwater with Albert Collins, John Lee Hooker, Ry Cooder, and Carlos Santana on stage at the same time. And calling favors.
Well, that's, and so all these parties take place at Sweetwater?
Yeah.
And you do it every single year?
No, for a while I was doing it twice a year, but it got really expensive and it got out of hand. I started trying to top myself every time and it just got top heavy. And it was taking the fun out of it. I mean, I had scheduled an anniversary party with the Grateful Dead and B.B. King.
But that is hard to tell.
And Jerry went and died, you know. But but he'd agreed to it. You know, Garcia was in buying some stuff, and I said, you know, I'd really like to have, you know, just you and Phil and Bob Weir and Bill Kreutzmann and Mickey Hart, you know, just the five of you do a set at Sweetwater for my anniversary party. And he agreed to it. And he not only agreed to it, Bob Weir came in about 2 weeks later and said, I hear we're doing a party. And then it got to the point, trying to schedule a date, and then working with B.B. King, trying to schedule a date to where he could do it, because he never has a night off. You know? And it got real top heavy, and it was getting to the point, and it didn't happen, and it was getting to the point where it wasn't fun anymore. And I just kicked back and said, you know, I can't do this anymore. So I did a few more, but I did them with people that I loved when I was growing up and that maybe nobody had ever heard of. The last one I did was probably two of my favorite soul singers out of the 60s, both of whom I had thought were dead. And I just threw a lot of this and that and weird coincidences. They were both alive and working, and I had them, you know, a guy named Howard Tate and a lady named Betty LaVette. And the one I did before that was a rockabilly duo called the Collins Kids that I'd loved when I was 15 years old. An R&B singer named Tommy Hunt that used to sing with the Flamingos and hadn't performed in this country in 30 years. Mm-hmm. And a guy from L.A. named Swamp Dog. You know, and I just decided, and they were great. On some level, those two parties were better than the Elvis Costellos and the Jerry Garcias and the John Lee Hookers and the Ry Cooders and the Carlos Santanas, because it was, you know, this is who I am and this is where I came from and this is what I love. You know, if somebody told me when I was 14 years old that someday the Collins Kids would play for a party for me, and I, yeah, right. Or when I was 14 years old that John Lee Hooker would play for a party for me, you know, I just, it's mind-blowing to me.
Well, it's what a thrill to meet your heroes and find that you like them as well.
Yeah, and it's not always true.
Yeah,
you know, but when it is, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's just wonderful. I one of my favorite musical moments was going to the W.C. Handy Blues Awards show in Memphis and going backstage after the show and having B.B. King introduce me to Carl Perkins as the owner of the best record store in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for a music freak, it doesn't get any better. You know, sex is really cool, but for a music freak, it just doesn't get any better.
Wow.
And, you know, there's moments like that. The first time B.B. King came in the store, it just happened to be on a day when one of the Coasters came in the store and Al Kooper came in the store. You know, it was a triple header day. Mm-hmm. And B.B. King walked in. And again, I'd been trying to finesse getting him to come over to the store through various and sundry people for a long time.
Where was he living here?
No, he used to come in every tour. Uh-huh. In fact, one tour, he pulled up both his tour buses across the street, and just before they went to the hotel, the whole band and entourage waited in the bus while he came in and bought his records. Uh-huh. First time he came in, I was showing some music videos back here, and I knew he was a Louis Jordan freak.
I have read this, yeah.
Yeah, and I put on some Louis Jordan videos, and B.B. King is a large man. And I don't know if you've noticed, but half my inventory is on the floor. And at one point, I turned around and B.B. King was gone. I found him sitting on the floor over on the aisle there with his legs kind of spread out, looking through Oscar Peterson albums with one hand, waving his arms, singing along with Louis Jordan. And I thought, oh, Jesus, nobody would believe this.
Wonderful, and he's a nice man, isn't he?
Oh, he's wonderful. He's one of my favorite people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a real sweetheart. He's almost too nice to be in the music business, and it amazes me that he's as successful as he is. I mean, he's a gentleman. He's a nice man. He's conversant about. I mean, we've sat and talked for hours on end, and he's just conversant about everything. So that's. I'd say three of my best friends that I've developed through the years in the music business are probably B.B. King, Elvis Costello, and Ry Cooder. And the one thing the three of them have in common is we can sit and talk for hours. And none of the three seem to be real chatty people, but we get rolling about so many different kinds of music. And B.B. King, we can talk about Tony Martin or Frank Sinatra. Elvis Costello, we can talk about Aretha Franklin or George Jones. Ry Cooder, we can talk about almost anybody in the world. You know, and just the breadth, and it's one of the reasons they're as talented as they are, is the breadth of knowledge they have about not just what they do, but all kinds of music.
Do you also talk politics with them?
Hardly ever. No, not at all.
That's interesting. Or personal things?
A little bit. Well, Rye, I do, because I've spent a lot of time staying at his house, and we went to Havana for a week together, and you know, we actually spent a lot of time together. But so Rye, yes. Elvis, a little bit. B.B. King, not so much.
Were you involved with the Buena Vista Social Club?
Not at all. I did. I went down with Rye and his wife to Havana for a week to rehearse one of their tours, spent a week in the rehearsal hall with them, which was just really wonderful.
I can imagine. That's the sort of thing you cannot replicate.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's perks to the business. I don't make any money, but I have a lot of perks.
Well, I was going to get to that, too, and I wanted, speaking of money, it's 10 of 10, so you probably have to get ready to choose your selection for today. But you make enough to get by, or do you do okay,
I have. Yeah, when I took over this store, it was the idea that I could live in Mill Valley, eat three meals a day, and feed my record collection, and mm-hmm. I've done that for 35 years.
Mm-hmm. And I hate to think that it would ever come to an end. But you obviously have been thinking about that.
I think it's going to happen, yeah.
And do you have staff that would buy it and run it?
The store doesn't make any money. Nobody's going to buy a store like this. You would have to be independently wealthy and have all the time in the world and absolutely love music and not need to draw a paycheck.
Well, that sounds like half the people who live in Nevada.
Yeah, that's very true. It's very true. You know, I would certainly, at some point, I'll announce that I am closing, and I would certainly entertain an offer if somebody wanted to buy it, but I don't foresee it happening. It would involve a humongous amount of money.
Yeah.
What you know, the memorabilia on the walls alone is probably worth $500,000.
And lots of it is signed, too.
Almost, yeah.
Speaking of that, it's kind of interesting that your security is so minimal. After so many years, you never had a concern for...
It's not the kind of stuff that your basic run-of-the-mill burglar is going to take. You know, it's really, there's never much money in the store. And to do any real damage, they would have to park a truck outside and take all night to load it. Yeah. You know, it's not... And pretty much if one particular item... You know, if the place got broken into in the middle of the night and one particular item was taken... I think, depending on what the item was, I'd have a pretty good idea who took it. You know, and you know, it's just not, you know, every once in a while something will get ripped off the wall when nobody's looking, but it's, the alternative is to have it all in a bank vault, and there's just, or in a drawer at home, and there's just no, that's a conscious decision I made 30 years ago, that if people can't enjoy it, if I can't enjoy it, then what's the point in having it?
Can you give me a quick rundown on the layout of the building, what it was like when you took over, and the stages of how you've expanded?
When I worked for Village Music in high school, it was in the little store that's in the Sequoia Theater building. Mm-hmm. She moved up here in 61 when the gas station was torn down and this building was built. And when I took over in 68, it was this space to this first wall.
Right. Yeah, that's what I
took the second space in 71, took the third space in 74.
And how about back here over?
That I just there was a wall where that doorway is, and I just took that out.
So you're actually in three buildings, three offices.
They were originally built so that it could be done in different combinations. Like this section here was just sheetrock and 2x4s. That doorway there was sheetrock and 2x4s, and then the equivalent of this section here on the other wall is just sheetrock and 2x4s. So there's only, you know, they could be two stores, they could be three, they could be four, or they could be one.
Could be many as four. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever think of, did you ever acquire something that was, made you almost drop it? You were so excited to see it.
Helen Wolf's first royalty check, right there. Bing Crosby's Army ID card, which is up there. Janis Joplin's mugshots from when she was busted for shoplifting in Berkeley, over there. They're not up, they're at home, but I've got Billie Holiday's passport. I've got a letter she wrote to her husband/drug dealer when she was in prison, a pencil-drawn 2-page letter. Stuff like that just
what about
gets me off.
Yeah. What about a particular album?
Not so, again, it depends on what mood I'm in. Mm-hmm. Nothing, most of my really emotionally favorite albums I got when I was way young, you know, and they were emotionally my favorites at the time, and have stayed that way.
That makes sense. It is said that you remember all the lyrics when you were 15 and 16.
That's what keeps a store like this in business. People buy their memories. You know, I have really elderly people coming in and buying Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey. I have people my age coming in and buying Chuck Berry and Little Richard. I have people a little bit younger coming in and buying the Supremes and the Temptations, and a little bit younger buying the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and a little bit younger buying David Bowie, and a little bit younger buying The Clash and Elvis Costello. You know, it's just, on some level, you go back to what you remember listening to when you were growing up, because it's an impressionable age. You know, my favorite songs are 45s that meant something to me at a particular time in my life. Mm-hmm. And they may not have been hits. You know, I may have picked them up for a nickel at Walgreens in the city. But it's just they connected with me on some level at the time, and they're still there.
And when you started the, this is sort of relating to that in a way, but when you have an anniversary party, mm-hmm. Is it the anniversary of when you bought the store, or is it Christmas? Or
it's I had some anniversary parties, which were just roughly X number of years in business, and I had some Christmas parties, which were roughly around Christmas. It mainly was, if I can get such and such a person on such and such a date, if it's not in December, we'll call it an anniversary party. Mm-hmm. Some of my anniversary parties, I took over the store in February. Some of my anniversary parties have been April or May. Some of them have been August or September. It just depends on when I can line up what I've got going.
Did you ever have any parties here?
I've had some live performances in here, some in-stores. And I've certainly had a lot of recording artists signing albums in here.
Okay, well, that's about it for me, unless there's something that you can think of that you were sort of hoping to be asked or glad you weren't asked.
Well, you skirted politics, and then you just dropped it.
Well, okay. I have a feeling you're not really high in the Iraq war. I don't know why I think that. And I wanted to ask you about Vietnam, actually, because you said you avoided the draft, I think.
Yeah, I did.
How'd you do that?
My father spent several years telling me the Army would make a man of me, and by the time it actually got to the point, my student deferment was no longer working anymore because I was going on 7 years and hadn't gotten a degree. You know, I was changing majors once a year and barely passing. By the time that happened, he decided maybe the Vietnam War wasn't the world's, maybe the Army was not the greatest idea for me. And he got a friend of his who was a doctor down in San Jose to write a letter saying I had an ulcer, and it worked.
And you didn't?
Incipient ulcer, I think he called it. He said, if you keep drinking to the extent you're drinking in college, you will have an ulcer, and that's good enough. And the doctor wrote a cover letter, and it worked. And the day it worked, I went back down to San Jose, and I dropped out of school, and I called Sarah up here and said, yes, I would love to take over the store.
Wow, that's
which was just a quick, which was a kind of a weird karmic thing anyway. I mean, Sarah called me. Sarah Wilcox was the owner of the store. She called me and said she was tired of it. She just didn't want to do it anymore. And she had a buyer. He was a retired sheet music salesman that she'd been dealing with for years and years, and he wanted to buy the store, and he wanted somebody to run it, and would I be interested in managing the store for him? And I said, yeah, I could do that. I wouldn't mind doing that if I get this draft thing out of the way. And so I got the draft thing out of the way. I called her. I met the guy. He was like 70, I think, and we got along great. He said, sure, we'll do it. He was literally on his way to the attorney's office to sign the papers and drop dead of a heart attack. Literally in his car on the way. And by that time, Sarah had made the mental mindset she just didn't want to be here anymore. And I suggested, why don't I work for you for a year or two for a percentage of the profits and earn up money to buy the business from you? And so we did it, and so I ended up owning it.
How old were you then?
I was 68. I was 24.
Mm-hmm. Was it more difficult or easier than you expected to be once you became the owner?
Well, it happened gradually. I mean, one, I had an established business. It's not like I was starting from scratch. Two, I had a vision of what I wanted to do. I mean, I'd run a department store, record department down in San Jose, and I worked as an assistant manager in a record store in San Jose while I was in college. And I knew what I wanted. I mean, when I took the store over, it was like, I don't know if you know the term, a typical little mom-and-pop record store. I mean, it had records, it had saxophone reeds and guitar strings and tambourines and radios and record players and guitars and drums and, you know, all of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did was get rid of all of it, you know. And I was going to be a record store. When I took over, there was one bin of rock, and there were 40 bins of classical. I rearranged my focus. There were like three blues records. You know, I was still pretty much a blues freak at the time. I was working, I don't know if you've ever heard of Jemco. It was kind of like White Front. It was a discount. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a small version of Target. And I worked in the record department in San Jose. And when I left, they had probably the largest blues and bluegrass collection on vinyl on the West Coast. They didn't sell it, but it was there. I mean, I had a killer record department there. No business, but a killer record department. And so I changed my focus, and I put in records, and then it just, it was just a gradual thing. But it was, you know, I had the time to be gradual because I had, you know, the store had been in business for 25 years already. So I had a built-in clientele that I could finesse. It wasn't a matter of starting just from scratch.
Actually, you reminded me of one question I didn't write down.
We got 2 minutes before the tape runs out.
When tapes started coming in, didn't you feel a dread?
Not really, because cassettes never impacted the record business.
What about CDs?
CDs impacted the record business to the extent that the record companies quit making records. You know, they impacted it to that extent. You know, if they kept making vinyl all along, there would not have been a problem. But they didn't. They made it impossible to buy new vinyl, and then they sold it one way. You couldn't return it if it was defective. You couldn't return it if it was a misshipment. They did everything they could to discourage stores from ordering it, and then they turned around and said, well, stores aren't ordering them. We'll quit making them. But it was totally engineered.
Mm-hmm. And very few places make vinyl now anyway.
Well, a lot do, but they may, you know, once the record companies realized that you could call it a limited edition and sell it for more than you can the CD, then vinyl looked like a good idea again. I mean, they put out a lot of records on vinyl now, and most of them cost more than the CDs. But there's still, you know, it's a specialty market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're about at the end, right?
You got about 40 seconds, and the tape's going to cut off.
Tell me your politics.
I think the town's very liberal, but it's liberal on its own terms, and I think it always has been. I think it's I don't think they stand up for what they believe. I think they believe what they think they should believe, but I don't think they fight for it. I don't think they ever have. I think this town's been, my dad used to call them pseudo-liberals, and I've never quit using the term, and I still think it's there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's a great attitude.
Okay.
Thank you.